Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. This is a time of year for reflection and looking back and forward. Living and learning involves loss. Some are as little as changing a life habit that's lost its luster, and some are as profound as losing a beloved. In all cases, loss leads to grief, a natural pathway that prepares us for the transition to living without something we depended on. I've begun to believe that grieving is essential for change and adaptation because it demands time and energy. People often try to leap over it in an attempt to just get on with it. Grief counselors report statistics showing incomplete grieving can contribute to future bad health outcomes. Hard though it is, grieving loss through life's transitions supports change and learning. Simply put, you have to show up to learn what life can teach us. So whether you're facing a complex health decision or recovering from the death of a loved one, grieving may be the key to moving on. I'm joined by Jeff Fawcett, PhD, my co-producer, an environmental economist, health educator, works with individuals, and writer and editor of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Bucks Medicine. And we'll be today discussing the issue of loss and its role in grieving and its role in transition. The first thing I want to do, though, is sort of do a little disclaimer. It's important to note that grief occurs throughout life. Even small things can cause a sense of loss, but some forms of grief are profound, especially with people who are already at risk, like the elderly or the chronically ill, to lose a spouse or a beloved loved one, or, God forbid, a child. It can actually precipitate a collapse, a health collapse. So it isn't, we aren't saying that everybody should just move through their grief with courage and no fear without help. It is easier to grieve with another, to share your grief, to express your feelings, and it may be necessary, depending on the depth of the grief, to work with a grief counselor, or if income is short, or if you prefer a group. There are lots of grief groups of different sorts, both for loss of loved ones and even loss of pets. So it's important not to become isolated when you've lost something that nurtured you. So I want to start by saying that when Jeff and I started to talk about this topic, one of the things that we wondered about is this is such a profound mind-body event, grief. It is so consuming. We wondered, what is it for? And Jeff, you kind of had some thoughts, and you also did some research.
After about an hour sitting in my office contemplating this, I always go to when something which appears to be not working in the body happens, I ask, why is this adaptive? Why is this healthy? So I kind of went back to some fundamentals. Emotions are here to literally help us survive. What I came to is that grief, the feeling of grief, of loss, unlike other basic emotions, is a response to an absence. Fear and happiness are in response to something which is present.
And coming at you, maybe.
And maybe coming at you. Mm-hmm. Whereas grief is about something which is absent, a beloved which is absent. And so when I started looking into the physiological processes in the brain that are going on, what came up was a lot of issues around planning and stress response. So our bodies are, our brain is getting us to focus on those very issues of the future and life without that object of our love.
And it's important to note here that it's much easier if people, obviously, it's easier if there's some preparatory time. Part of what you're saying is that the grief itself is preparatory for life without the beloved.
What's actually, in terms of just, again, sticking with the physiology, what's happening in the brain is one of the things that emotions do is focus our attention on a particular aspect of our environment. And in this case, it focuses a part of our brain, our limbic system, on planning, that is, on the future. And so we tend to dwell on the thing in the past. How are we going to go on without them? That's what we get focused on. And that's a healthy thing because that's the thing we have to move through.
Yeah, it's a common theme for people experiencing a loss. And there's, as I've said before, many levels of this where you find that you're obsessing. You're just looping through and you're going over everything. Did I do everything I should have? Did I say everything? Could I have done more? Blah, blah, blah. If it's a creature or a person or, you know, a beloved, a live thing, you know, an animal or a soul,
yes,
you were identifying with. But I think that people think that because there's an obsessive component to this, that that's not a good thing. But in fact, what you're saying is that the way that this is very similar to the kind of pattern that we have when we're learning something new. If you go to another country and you're learning a new language, what you'll discover is that as you go to bed at night, as your consciousness kind of softens and you're vulnerable, you will have this experience of practicing hearing the language in your head and practicing it. Or if you're learning some kind of physical thing, you'll find yourself going through the steps as you fall asleep. And then you dream of it and you do all this stuff. So it is an aspect of learning, and that's what we know about how the brain adapts to stress. And, of course, loss and grieving is a stress response. So it isn't just how can I protect myself from ever having pain again. It's more, in this case, how can I adapt and change. And it includes, unfortunately, the painful aspect of combing through every detail of what happened. And I guess what we're saying is don't be afraid of that process, because one of the things that we know about emotional stuff is that expression of feeling mitigates the destructive physical effects of shock and trauma. Expression of it is both. Bill Moyers many years ago did a series called Healing in the Brain, and in there interviewed neurologists and psychologists and psychiatrists who had studied brain function through emotion, and they discovered that expressing feeling, even if it was an actor faking it but still having the feelings, that opened up the immune system and made it function. On the other hand, when that doesn't happen, there's no lack of research. If people now Google grief, you will see, especially if you go to the scholarly pages, you'll see no end of research saying basically that grief causes sudden death, causes heart disease, causes all these horrible events. And there's no, I couldn't get into any of the articles. And so I, you know, it was, but we also know from Robert Sapolsky that when he studies monkeys and they misbehave with each other and they stress each other out, that the monkeys who express their feelings have a lower stress response. The old joke of the upper level manager dealing with the lower level manager, that the upper level manager doesn't get ulcers, he gives them to other people. And that's true, that the expressive animals and humans have a lower stress response. We survive better. And one last piece of research that's interesting in this regard is, I was going to mention later, but I'm going to say it now because it's the research that I got my hands on, is that there was some research some time back, and I actually produced an article for the Progressive Health Observer about different forms of estrogen, one breaking your heart and the other protecting your vaginal mucosa. But the point was that there was a study that came out that said that people after a shock or a trauma, like the loss of a beloved, especially women, will have, it's more common in women, but can have a heart event, and it feels like a real heart event, and they go to the hospital, and they wire them up, and they check them, and there's no damage, there's no heart attack, but they did have a traumatic event, and the shock did produce an ischemic heart event or various things that look like a heart attack, although no heart attack actually occurred, or if it did occur, it was so minor that there was a fast recovery. And the only thing they posited, the only thing they knew for sure, was that this seemed to happen more often in postmenopausal women. And what we know about postmenopausal women is that the early stages of menopause, women lose progesterone, which has a calming effect. Estrogen is excitatory, progesterone is calming. And so what I wrote about was that when your sex hormones are balanced and you have enough of the supportive hormones, in the men it would be testosterone, in women it would be progesterone, your response or outcome to shock and trauma will be softer and better. But those hormones are also contested and driven down by high stress hormones. So part of what we're learning is that healthy response to stress is expressive. That there is a, as you saw in the research, a profound effect from the brain controlling the hormones to the hormonal effect. And so that part of what you want to do in caring for yourself is, you know, if you're a woman or even if you're a man, a tiny dose of, for a man you don't want to do much, but, you know, making sure that your sex hormones are protecting you or that you're mitigating the stress response to the cortisol. Go ahead with what you're going to say.
Grief as an emotion, the hypothalamus, that part of the brain which it communicates from the brain to the endocrine system, that is all of your hormones, is more active in grief than in any of the other emotions. The other area of the brain which is more active than in any other area of the basic emotions is a structure called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which no one is expected to remember, but that is an area of the brain which is responsible for our evaluation of the future. It's about planning. It is also the locus of our sense of humor.
Yeah, interesting.
I make sense of this by something a friend of mine who is a playwright told me once. He wrote comedies, and he said the key to writing a good comedy is to take it just to the point where it's not painful yet. If something becomes painful, you've gone too far. But good comedy brings it up to the point where it's almost painful. And I think those processes are involved with us actively working through what has happened to us, what we're faced with in the absence of a beloved. Both the fact that on the one hand, our endocrine system is getting a lot of messages. The part of our limbic system that in fear elicits fight, flight, or freeze response is dampened. So our response from this is not to run away or protect ourselves physically, but it may manifest itself in expressiveness from the hormonal effect and the perception of planning or the physically acting through of things to move into the future. That's why ritual becomes very important in these situations, because we are literally moving into the future without.
And also making room for something else.
Yes.
Yeah, making some room. Boy, that was a mouthful. Let's see. Well, how did I want to respond to that? There's sort of good news, bad news about having a brain like this. And the bad news from the perspective of stress is that human beings rehearse things. It's also the good news that we rehearse things. So the bad news is that we can scare ourselves with a thought, or we can throw ourselves into grief with a thought. I have a bad habit of every time my beloved something goes wrong, I think the relationship's over and I go right to grief. So some of us slide down that slide very quickly, and that's why I was saying at the beginning of the show, this is not a unique event. It happens throughout life. We have death and life mingled all the time. There are losses along the way, and then you get new stuff and blah. So the good news, bad news about the brain is that we rehearse, and it can scare us and traumatize us, but it can also help us to move on because it's involved in learning, and that's what we do. We learn, and we're not the only creatures that do that. Animals learn also. The tricky part here is that it's clear that it is important for us to take advantage of the full impact of this, and that's why I said at the top of the show that people should take into consideration how much help they're going to need with this, because among other things, it's very important in order for this to become real for you. And this is whether, and now we're sort of talking about massive grief, where you have real loss, not just giving up sugar, although we're going to talk about giving up sugar later too, but massive grief, terrible disappointment and shock of various sorts, that time and preparation for it, taking the time to really experience it, makes it real. I spoke with a friend who had, you know, this is one of those experiences that is, this is never supposed to happen. You know, it's one of these not supposed to happen thing where he lost his sister, who was in her 30s and had two small children, to cancer. And there was a month where she knew that she was dying, and none of the rest of the family members would interact with her. And what he did was he spent every second he could with her, and told her absolutely everything he needed to say to her. And they talked about how she felt about dying. They exchanged important items that meant something to each other. So he had something of hers that he could treasure, that would have her feeling for him. So that when she died, he was prepared and it was real. When you have a situation where the death is a shock, if it's possible, I mean, I never understood this until now because it's just not part of my tradition. If it's possible to have a tangible experience of sitting with the body of someone who's passed or a pet that's passed and giving yourself time to do that thing that you couldn't do when they were still alive, that is very important. That's preparatory, and it makes it real. And as you say, no matter what, that's why physical rituals can help you move through. I should probably ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're talking about loss and healing through transition, which is what grief is. It's getting ready to live without something. And then I guess the last thing was just this concept, again, of making room for something else. And I do believe that it is not possible to love without grief. I think that love, real love, and the stronger the love, the more precious the love, the more painful the grief, not just if they go away, but even mingled within the experience of loving, there's disappointment and loss and grief. And I think that, you know, I don't think that non-attachment means not experiencing dependency and love. I think it means moving through your emotional life and your grief so that you move on, with that experience of a loved one, whether they're still with you and you're having problems and you go through cycles, or whether they've actually gone, that you've folded them into the dough of your life so that they're kneaded into you and they stay with you, but that in fact you are ready to receive something else, some other love. You had something.
Yeah. One of the things that we often don't think about emotions as doing is that they focus our attention. Yeah. And by the process of just the physiological process of grief, we're very focused on the absence of that other. And in the process of focusing on that absence, as we physically move through, as we move through whatever it is we're doing to prepare, to sit with the person, or to move them, or ultimately to whatever death ritual we go through, that is part of the process of moving through those emotions and moving from one emotional state to the next, to the next, to the next. It's an emotional transition that we're going through, as well as moving into our future, actually understanding what our future is, and then learning to live with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's both the future being in front of us, and then it's also this thing of time not being completely linear, because it also, everything gets folded back
yes.
in. Everything gets folded back in. Nothing has a distinct and separate self. You know, it's all mixed back into it. Why don't you talk a little bit about the stages? You know, obviously everybody knows about the Kubler-Ross writings, but what you discovered is there are many people writing about these stages, and everybody has a different explanation, but I think you can probably, in your own words, describe the stages.
Well, I knew the Kubler-Ross kind of description of mm-hmm. stages of grief, and what I oriented towards is not so much a description of what do people go through, but how do you take control of that process? How do you actively move through that process? And so I turned to one literature on how people change that describes stages through which as we know, and it's particularly in a situation like this, it's not simply that the person or the loved one is there and then they're not there and you get on with your life. There is a shock, no matter how prepared you are, there is a shock. And it's the big no. And that corresponds to what's called a stage of change, which is kind of preliminary to you really being ready to change. And what shifts into the next stage, which is to actually an emotional, psychological phase in which you're actually contemplating change, thinking about it, you're evaluating it, is a shift in not what you think about, what is good or bad, but how you feel about it. It's an emotional commitment that says, in this case, okay, I'm ready to do what needs to be done to move into the future. So we then are in a situation where we're trying to figure out how we can actually change, how we can move into our future. And then we move into a phase where we're actually planning on what are we going to do? How are things going to change? Then we move into a phase in which, okay, we're ready. We're going to make our life different. Here's what we're going to do. So in terms of a concrete experience, it would be someone has just died. I don't even want to think about this. But one of the things of sitting with someone who has died.
Or a pet
that has died, that helps you do is physically grasp that this thing has happened, and then you can move into the next phase, which is, okay, I have to deal with this. I am eventually, if it's a pet, I'm going to have to bury them. That doesn't mean you immediately go out and pick up the shovel. It means that I have to get ready to do this, and then in its time, you move to actually digging the hole, and they go in the ground. Now, that's not the end of it. They're not in the ground, and then it's all over, and everything has changed. You then go into a fourth phase, which is to you are going on with your life. Now, that sounds kind of odd, but you are now in a changed state. You have a life without that loved one. And one of the very common things that happens when people go through this process of change is they have relapses. They fall back to a stage where, an earlier stage, where they, in a sense, they have fall back to a stage in which they haven't adapted. So that you go past that site in your garden where that pet is buried, and you see them, and the grief grips you again. You're taken by it again. That doesn't mean you haven't, that something unhealthy is going on. It's actually quite normal for that sort of relapse to happen, that you fall back. But again, if you look at it as a process of change, you'll be able to move to the next stage when you're ready. And that whole issue of time is extremely important. It takes the time that it does.
Well, and it's important for this to be done in a healthy physical way for you to actually take some time off if you have a busy life, to take some time out for this. Certainly the soul that you're grieving for deserved that. If you love them that much, they deserve for you to, and you deserve it. You deserve to have the time to integrate this experience. And I think going back over it, feeling the grief over and over again is like practicing a language. You have to keep, you know, because you've had this very profound connection. And the connection is severed. So, I mean, that's the thing about death. It's so odd. It doesn't, the person doesn't walk around, or the creature, the animal, your loved, your pet, you know, it doesn't go around sort of fading from your view, slowly getting lighter and lighter, and then saying goodbye. They're there, and then they're not there. Yes. And it's like, you know, somebody said, it's like if you're taking some nutrients or eating some food that really works for you, and then you're completely cut off from that thing, your body suffers for that loss. So it's just, your body can't adapt that fast either.
I think that this process is not just a mental one or even an emotional one. I think it's literally a physical one.
Yes. Well, they're connected. It's the same.
It's all connected. Yeah. So we need to think of it not just as, oh, I'll feel better, or I won't grieve, or I'll stop crying. It's, you will physically feel different.
Let me go over a few things that a sort of care and feeding of yourself during grieving. One of the things that you notice when you read any conventional research about grieving is that it has a pretty powerful effect on your immune system. It tends to suppress the leukocytes, white cells, and so people are vulnerable to getting sick during that period. And also there's that horrible thing that happens, well, horrible because you can't sleep, is that you lay in bed and you're going over stuff, and it wakes you up, and your mind is very active. And again, this is not, the body does stuff for a reason, and this is a reason. This is for a reason too. So it's better to think that than to think, "Oh, I'm." And some things that may be helpful is that obviously you want to do whatever immune boosting stuff you generally do. You want to make sure that you're eating sufficient protein, because stress burns up protein. Whatever kind of protein you choose, that should be assimilatable. Your gut should be handling it. Vitamin C is a huge reliever of stress. B vitamins, but calcium and magnesium have a relaxant effect. You can put magnesium Epsom salts in your bath to relax yourself. But all the nutrients are important under stress. They're all important. They all get burned up. All the antioxidants, everything gets burned up under stress, because you're just your metabolism is kind of it's like your homeostasis is unbalanced, so everything's a bit unbalanced. In terms of insomnia relief, one thing to try, and you can really use all of these at once if you want to, if it's really bad. GABA is amino acid that hooks into a receptor in your brain that relaxes you. It's the same receptor that your brain gets when progesterone works. And again, if men do want to use progesterone, it has to be teensy dose, like 5 milligrams. You know, women are more like 20 milligrams twice a day. So GABA, you know, maybe even, like, this would be before bed. You don't take a bunch of GABA and get behind the wheel of a car, because it'll relax you too much. So GABA will not have an ill effect. It's just an amino acid that exists in food, but if you take it away from food before you go to bed, 1,000 milligrams, You can take it again if you want during the night. If you take it too close to waking, it'll make you feel a little groggy in the morning. Rescue Remedy is great stuff. I think somebody told me there's a Rescue Remedy for sleep now. There are homeopathic remedy mixes, like emotional mixes and sleep mixes, insomnia mixes, but there's also Ignatia Imara. I'm not sure I'm going to spell this right. Ignatia. Imara is Imara. That may be spelled right. Ignatia Imara is particularly good for grief, and a 30C or 30X pellets under your tongue as you need it. You don't take homeopathics unless you need them. Extra rest, no joking around. If you're not sleeping, you rest however you can. You don't push yourself. You do gentle exercise like walking because it helps. The physical activity will help you process what you're going through and help you sleep. If your blood pressure is low, if you have a way of checking that, if your pulse and your blood pressure are getting low, you're probably getting a low cortisol dip. If your blood pressure is high, you're probably getting a high cortisol dip. If your blood pressure is low, using some licorice tea or some licorice tincture, maybe taking some extra potassium during the day, because some susceptible people will lose potassium when they take licorice. Chamomile, no kidding, really is relaxing. I said all the nutrients, magnesium in your bath, immune boosters, however you like them. There's various kinds out there, anti-flu things, flu homeopathics, oxaliconium, echinacea, various things that help to support. There's Russian Choice Immune, which is a broken cell, acidophilus bifida kind of thing. Massage, acupuncture appointments, group interactions and connections, really connecting with people you can talk to and talking about this. Meditation, especially if you're not sleeping, increases energy exponentially. There was a study done recently that people get more energy from meditation than they do from naps. So we are ready to take a brief musical break. You are listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Dr. Fawcett, and we are talking about loss, healing through transition. We're going to take a break for a minute or so, and we'd like for you to stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we are talking about loss and grief, healing through transition. If you missed parts of today's show and you want to get a copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, you can either go to our website and listen to the current show all week long at yourownhealthandfitness.org with Anne spelled out. But you'll also find information on the Progressive Health Observer, both articles and the newsletter itself, and Radio On Demand, where you can download archives and articles right on the spot. Or you can call us at 707-874-2772, or if you want to reach Dr. Fawcett directly, that's 707-874-1496. So we wanted to shift this conversation a bit and discuss how this applies to not just preserving your health through grieving situations, but how it actually plays into making healthcare decisions. Because one thing that I now see in my practice, and Jeff and I have talked about it, he sees it in his practice as well, working with individuals, is that, well, there's a couple of things I see. One is that there's an unfortunate aspect to the human, to our culture anyway, and the human brain and the way we think and things, emotional life, is that we often, as you know, don't really appreciate something until it's gone. There's that, and we always kick ourselves. So, oh, geez, you know, I mean, when my shoulder wasn't hurting, I never really loved my shoulder, you know. Now it's hurting. But in a much more grave way, health is taken for granted until something happens, and then people feel very betrayed by their bodies, and they feel a bit angry, and there's a lot of denial. And, hey, guess what? That's grief. That's loss. That's what it is. And what I see is that somebody will come to me having gone to a conventional doc, and the doc says standard of care. Here's the standard of care. And it's based on medical information that is basically censored both to the doctor and the public in terms of what gets out, because there's other research that people don't get their hands on that it's credible scientific research. Nobody's talking about it, which is what we try to do on the show. But the point is that they're told this one very narrow way of dealing with their situation, and it's usually pretty invasive and quite frightening, and fear is the operative word. And what people are presented with is they're told that there's no time. And the first thing I always say to people is, that's not so. And what we just discussed is that you cannot wrap your brain around a situation of loss unless you have some time to make the emotional shift into believing that this is actually happening. So whatever it is, whatever kind of loss of your health, whether you become suddenly a diabetic or you're a woman and they're telling you that they yank your uterus, this is an opportunity for you. You must take the time. And it's usually not true that there's no time. There usually is time for you to figure this out. Certainly there's a week or a month. You know, I mean, there are some very critical diagnoses where you have to move pretty fast, but there's always some time, you know, whether it's a day or something, for you to stop and focus on what's happening and go through these stages we're talking about. And then in the planning stage, begin to accumulate information and notice how what you can do to affect it. Now, many of the types of things that we see is that somebody's had a fairly vigorous life and then they're suddenly tripped up by something that looks on the surface of it like it could potentially be serious. That's not. And it's serious in the sense that it requires you to take a sharp right turn and change, and really change your diet, change your lifestyle, lots of changes. But you may be able to mitigate what's going on over time if you do those things, but it means changing things that you really depended on, the style of eating that you had, you know, certain work habits or whatever. You might have to let go of some stuff and do some stuff that, until you're used to it, feels profoundly uncomfortable. So it's grief, again. The thing that I keep noticing is that people, when I start to give them information on non-invasive measures to use to work with their situation, to get their body back to some kind of better balance for the future, I'm often overwhelmed with people's yes budding, you know, oh, I can't do that, or that's too annoying, I can't, you know. And I was commenting that sometimes people will say, well, you understand, don't you? And I go, well, no, because I mean, I'm not bragging. I got very sick in my 30s. When I discovered how I could get out of it, I just did what I had to do to get better. And I don't do things that I know are going to make me worse. I just don't want to feel bad. So I don't understand. But in trying to understand this, I have turned to this grief research and just paying attention to this issue of loss and grief in taking on caring for yourself, that the only way that I can understand that people can't embody these changes is because they're not emotionally ready. They're not feeling the emotional things they need to feel. They haven't accepted that there's something different. Did you want to comment?
Well, I'd like to reinforce that by the talking about, in terms of this framework of stages of change, that remember that the key element of moving someone, of moving yourself from a stage where you know that making a change is a good thing, or that you need to make a change, but you're not there yet. And the trick is to figure out the emotional commitment, how you get the emotional commitment. And there are all sorts of ways to do that, but the way that I think about it, maybe it's because I'm an economist, is that you're marketing to yourself. What are the things that are going to motivate you, it's not even motivating you, it is what are the things that are going to touch the right emotional chords that will make you see and feel that future. And in terms of what we're talking about here of grief and loss, if you're faced with a diagnosis in which your life as you knew it is in the past, you now have a new situation, health situation to deal with, what is the thing, or what are the things that will help you emotionally grasp that new future?
You have some suggestions?
In the context of concrete things, again, it's thinking like a marketer. What are the things that move you? So that, for instance, if what you're contemplating is things having to do with exercise, then literally leaving reminders around about exercise.
Well, in fact, there was an interesting article in today's paper that it's young people, particularly women, who read diet articles in magazines have eating disorders, you know, because they see all this propaganda.
Yes. That actually is very interesting. That's an interesting kind. I hadn't even thought about that. I read the article and was horrified. But that makes perfect sense in a broader way because we get messages, and essentially what you want to do to make that transition is to send yourself messages, and you know what information you're going to pick up and what you aren't. So it may be that you don't want to have those kinds of magazines around so that you don't get that message, because the message that's being that's coming from those magazines clearly is not have a healthy diet. It's get as skinny as possible, and that's the wrong message. Mm-hmm. So it is a marketing campaign. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to touch those emotional chords with the right information.
One thing, I was, many years ago, I trained people, and I sort of did a lot of rehab, but I also did just work with people who wanted to bodybuild and improve their bodies, and I tried to base it on how their body actually worked, you know, instead of just here's the usual way to do it, see you later. I'd actually work with them, and it was fun. And people would see these remarkable changes, which was really cool. And one of the things that I always said to people, and I still think this is true with exercise, is that your body-mind is very much like a child or even the pets that we love, very much like it. It wants to please you. It wants you to be happy. It wants to do what you want. So it will adapt to whatever you throw at it, and if it has to, it'll adapt badly, which is the case of with a bad diet or something. It'll just adapt around it, which is why sometimes people don't have symptoms until it's gone on too long. But in the same way with exercise, if you inspire and cajole the part of you that's childlike instead of disciplining, because I don't think that having commandments and discipline is the way to do it, even if you don't feel like exercising, because Lord knows I'm, you know, at this age, I still weightlift and stuff, but there are days when I just don't feel like doing it, but I know that it works. So I have a conversation with myself, you know, you're going to feel better. This is good for, you know, you're going to like the way your body looks. You're going to like the fact that your body functions well. And then, so I go in. But when I was younger, it was focusing on some of the aspects of it that were exhilaratory, you know, that were where you have no control of anything in your life, but if you exercise a muscle, it grows. How cool is that? You know, whatever it was. So cajoling and inspiring rather than commanding and disciplining always works better. And then obviously with exercise particularly, it's always better if you start with something that you can actually enjoy, whether that's walking. Often walking with a friend is the way to do it, so you can yammer and talk and forget that you're actually exercising. If you can't walk for some reason, choose something else that you like.
Just to put this in the context of, again, talking about grief, of loss, you're moving into a life that is not the same as the one you had before, that you want that life to be attractive. So to reinforce this idea of, oh, I need to do this because it's good for me, that's not going to get you there. What's going to get you there is what literally moves you into your future.
Well, you know, in that end, let me just quickly say, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we're talking about loss and transitions, you know, health decisions and transitions now, grieving and moving into a new thing, transitions. People often talk to me about the way their doctors talk to them, and I think to myself, how could you work with that person? This is such a delicate, you're on this very delicate edge with this person. I never work with a physician unless I feel, to some degree, I have to feel respected, I have to feel heard, and it's better if I really like them. And if you try long enough and hard enough, eventually you find someone you like, not only that you like, but actually listens to what you're saying, because remember, you're hiring a contractor, you're not,
right.
This is not our creator that you're talking to, whoever that is. The point is that in the same way, if you're working with a healthcare professional of any sort, whether it's a doctor or an acupuncturist, whoever, who inspires you and teaches you, not commands, not disciplines, and most of all, does not scare you.
Right. Absolutely.
Because, you know, there's a wonderful book, I don't know if it's still in print, that was written about by a woman with chronic fatigue while she had chronic fatigue, called The Alchemy of Illness. And again, I don't know if it's still in print. Her name was Kat, with a K, K-A-T, Duff, D-U-F-F. And one of the things that she talked about is that, you know, the medical profession looks at death as a failure. And so they have this, they can't fail. So you cease to exist as an individual, and there's this like mission. Death is not the worst outcome, and I'm not saying this lightly. I'm saying that sometimes going through horrible invasive treatments that may actually still result in you dying and then suffering terribly may not be the best decision for you if you have a critical diagnosis. You need to decide, and it should not be based on fear. Because as I said, death may not be the worst outcome. It may not be a failure. I'm not suggesting that it's, you know, that we should want that or whatever. Don't misunderstand. What I'm saying is, don't let them use fear as a driving force. And it gets used in a very complicated way. You know, we've been doing our editorials on the air all this time, and we put them up on our blog, which you can get to through our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, and both of us have been commenting on what gets reported in the newspaper and what the headlines say, and then you dig into the study and you notice that it's not at all what the study actually showed. And yet this is the information that gets put out there, and it frightens people into either inaction or doing really dumb things, and then their doctors push them. So I thought it would be interesting to use some examples.
Yeah, it's that messaging thing that I've come to believe that what, particularly in terms of health, reporting on health, science reporting on health, what's happening is messages are being sent. And they're censored, and they are often biased as distinct from having a perspective. 'Cause I've had clients who've come to me who for instance, stopped taking vitamin E because there was a big headline that said vitamin E doesn't work, and the study is just complete nonsense. And you can figure it out even by reading the newspaper article. But the message came across loud and clear. So one of the things that I've written about recently, several articles, had to do with reports from a breast cancer conference that was held in Texas that made big headlines. One, for instance, said that a low-fat diet was probably good for you in terms of
That was the recommendation from the study,
but when I actually looked at the study, it was extremely limited, and there were all sorts of issues that came up that a critical person would question. And the ones that this study in particular was interesting because researchers within the conventional genre were critical of it and kind of tore the study apart itself. And so I kind of stood back and said, what's the process that produces this kind of headline? So we've got this message, low fat prevents cancer. That's the message that people will walk away with. It's not based on particularly good research, even by the conventional standards. So why did that make a headline? Well, it makes news. It bleeds, it leads. That will get people's attention. But how did it get into that pipeline in the first place? And there is an institutional structure which says this is important news and other news is ignored. So there's a two-stage censorship. There's conventional institutions which have a public, universities and research institutions have public relations departments, and those public relations departments promote particular studies to journalists. Journalists pick those up and they spin them in a particular way. Mm-hmm. And the state of science reporting is such that you, as a consumer of health information, are not really provided with the information that will help you make a decision.
Well, I think we owe it to our listeners to go back and explain very briefly why vitamin E is not dangerous. And just very quickly, the deal is that the studies were done with a synthetic form of vitamin D, and it was done with very low doses, and it's dose-dependent. Very low doses won't do it. And they gave the vitamin E to people by itself without using other vitamins. And vitamin E is an antioxidant that even more than some of the other ones, and all of them work together, has to be taken with other vitamins and antioxidants. So it was very badly designed, and you know, it's similar to all the stuff that's been done on hormones, women's hormones, where they just refuse to use bioidentical progesterone. They just refuse to do it. So instead they just say, oh, hormones are dangerous, go off your hormones. And what they're really saying is synthetic, non-bioidentical patented progestins like Provera are dangerous, because they block the healthy effects of everything else, including your estrogen, and they cause problems instead of, you know. So, and then the issue with low fat, why don't you just very quickly, because we're running out of time, how come it wasn't a credible piece of research?
The impression from the message from the headline is low fat prevents cancer. That actually was not what they studied. What they studied was the recurrence of cancers in women over a period of time, in terms of low-fat diet versus normal diet. But even the normal diet was actually fairly low in fat. And the question that came up for me is, well, has anyone ever studied what happens if a woman is on a high-fat diet? What's the quality of the fats that those women were eating?
What were they
None
eating?
Of those questions were asked.
Yeah, and what other lifestyles? And
what other lifestyles things were going on?
A couple of ones that I reported on that are similar in style is there was a research thing about how it said that a mood that women have this mood disorder, that there's this mood disorder that women have. And they're talking about postpartum depression. And they basically go through this whole thing about how it's a mood disorder and it's really serious and that it represents hormone fluctuations after birthing, but there were no recommendations in the articles or the studies, for that matter, about how to rebalance the hormones. The only thing I did say is that there was mixed results using an antidepressant because antidepressants have been found in both children and adults to increase suicidal thoughts, so, gee. And what I said in the blog is that for 3 decades, John Lee, MD, treated his patients with bioidentical, same thing that your body makes, transdermal progesterone, and what we know, and never saw any incidence of any postpartum depression or breast cancer or anything in his 30-year practice. During pregnancy, a woman produces up to 400 milligrams of progesterone through her placenta, and then she dumps the placenta. It's expelled, and suddenly the progesterone level just hits the floor. And progesterone, as I've said, is one of your feel-good, calm hormones. So you get rid of that, you have a terrible hormone, you know, imbalance. And transdermal progesterone can be used when a woman's nursing. You just use a small amount. The baby will get a little bit of it, but it will calm the baby down. And you're not going to be using amounts that are going to be so high that you're going to affect a male baby, for instance. It's very small amounts. So that's one aspect of oh, my God, scary postpartum. Oh, my God, they kill their children. They do these terrible things. And it's like, hello, a little transdermal progesterone, but nobody ever discusses it. Just a bad, scary, oh, geez, what do we do? Get a drug. And then there was the red meat and breast cancer thing, which is similar to your low fat, which in its own article actually said, you know, I posited that in recent histories, the rates of breast cancer have increased, and actually people's consumption of red meat has gone down because people have been scared off of it. They they considered the processed meats versus others, and they did say that processed meat products with nitrates and stuff were worse, but they also showed a positive effect or lower risk in women eating bacon. For all of the estrogen positive or negative, blah blah blah. So their conclusions report that the consumption of all these meat products, all of them that you can think of, when eaten in sandwiches or with other foods, had no effect on breast cancer risk. But that isn't what the headline said. What the headline said is red meat causes breast cancer, and the conclusions of the article says red meat increases breast cancer in both menopausal and postmenopausal women. That's not what it said. So, fear, fear, fear. Now, before we lose, we have to go. But the last thing I want to say is whether you're facing recovery from addiction, whether you're looking at dietary changes, changes in physical activity, you have to have an emotional shift to get ready to make the changes. And that's why grieving and feeling a sense of loss so that you can get ready to move on is an important aspect of that. Yes?
Indeed. And unfortunately, we are in a situation where fear is what we get blasted with. Yeah. So pause. Time.
Time. Take time. And that's it for this hour. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772 for a list of other available shows, information about guests, the Progressive Health Observer, and Radio on Demand, where you can download archives and articles. Go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you need to reach Jeff Fawcett, he's at 707-874-1496. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.